there in Seattle. I had hired him soon after Christine brought little Alex to live there. We'd talked a couple dozen times since then, on my dime, of course. He was an excellent attorney, a good guy, too, but his message was a bad sign. My guess was that Christine had taken her own interpretation of what had happened in California and run with it, straight to her counsel. With the time difference out west, I was able to catch Benabasian still in the office. He tried to emphasize the positive for me, but his tone was all bad. Alex, this is only temporary, but they've also filed an ex parte motion asking for sole physical custody of Alex Jr. until the final hearing is over. The judge went for it. I'm sorry to have to tell you that. I squeezed the phone tight in my hand. It was hard to respond or even take in what Ben was telling me. Christine had never gotten this aggressive before. Now she seemed to be trying to keep me from even seeing little Alex. In fact, she just succeeded, at least temporarily. Alex, are you there? Yeah, Ben, I'm here. Sorry. Just give me a second. I put down the phone and took a deep breath. It would do me no good to spiral down right now, or to blow up over the phone. None of this was Ben's fault. I put the phone back to my ear. What was the basis for the claim? I asked. Not that I didn't already know, or at least suspect. Concern for Alex's safety. The motion cited the dangerous police work you were doing while you were in California with him. The fact that you supposedly abused your privileges while he was in your care at Disneyland. Ben, that's bullshit. It's a complete rearrangement of the facts. I consulted on a case with LAPD. I'm assuming as much, he told me. Ann Billingsley's her attorney. It's not beyond her to do a little grandstanding, even at this phase. Don't let it get to you, okay? Ben went on. Besides, there's some good news here, believe it or not. An earlier trial date means they have less time for Christine to establish a status quo under the new arrangement. The judge isn't supposed to take these temporary orders into account, but it's like unringing a bell. So the sooner, the better, really. We were actually lucky to get on the calendar this early. Great, I said. Lucky us. Ben told me to write an account of exactly what happened in California. I had been keeping a diary at his advice ever since I'd hired him. It included time spent with Alex, things I noticed about his development, family photos, and, maybe most important, any concerns I had about Christine. The fact that she had whisked our son away from me 2 days early certainly qualified. Those ups and downs of hers were a concern, deeply troubling. Was this latest development one of them? There's one other thing, Ben told me. You might not like it a whole lot. Listen, you find something for me to like about all this and I'll double your fee. Well, one of your strongest arguments is going to be Alex's relationship to his siblings. Jenny and Damon aren't going on the witness stand, I said flatly. That's a no, Ben. I won't allow it. How many times had I seen capable adult witnesses eviscerated in a courtroom? Too many to even consider putting my kids up there. No, 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 Ben assured me. Definitely not. But it would have a positive impact if they could be present for the hearing. You want Alex back, don't you? That's our goal, right? If I'm wrong about that, then I don't want to spend time on your case. I looked around my office as if for some kind of magic answer. I'm going to have to think about it, I finally said. I'll get back to you. Remember the big picture, Alex. This isn't going to be pleasant, far from it. But it'll be worth it in the long run. We can win this thing. We will win. He was so calm and collected. Not that I expected him to get emotional. I just wasn't in the mood for a rational conversation with my attorney. Can we talk first thing tomorrow? I asked. Sure. But listen, you can't give up hope. When we get in front of a judge, you need to know in your heart that you're the best parent for your son. That doesn't mean we have to trash Christine Johnson, but you can't come in looking, seeming, or even feeling defeated. Okay? I'm not defeated. Not even close to it. I can't lose my son, Ben. I won't lose Alex. I'll do everything I can to make sure that doesn't happen. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Call me at work or at home. You have my cell? I have it. I don't know if I said goodbye to Ben or even hung up before I threw the phone across the room. Chapter 31. What's going on up there? Nana called from below. Alex, are you okay? What happened? I looked at the smashed phone on the floor and felt unhinged. It's all right, I called back. I just dropped something. Everything's fine. Even the little lie didn't sit well with me, but I couldn't face anyone right now. Not even Nana Mama. I pushed back from my desk and put my head down between my knees. God damn Christine. What was wrong with her? It just wasn't right, and she had to know that. She couldn't have chosen a worse way of going about this, either. She was the one who decided to leave, who said she was unfit to be Alex's mom. She told me that. She used the word unfit. And she was the one who kept changing her mind. Nothing had ever changed for me. I wanted Alex from the moment I set eyes on him. And I wanted him even more now. I could see his face. His shy little smile. A cute wink he'd developed lately. I could hear his voice inside my head. I wanted to give him a big hug that wouldn't stop. It felt so unfair, so completely wrong-headed. All I had in me was anger and even a little hatred for Christine, which only made me feel worse. I'd give her a fight if that's what she wanted. But it was insane that she did. Breathe, I told myself. I was supposed to be good at staying calm in a bad situation, but I couldn't help feeling that I was being punished for doing my job, for being a cop. I don't know how long I sat up there, but when I finally left the attic, the house was dark and still. Janny and Damon were asleep in their rooms. I went in and kissed them goodnight anyway. I took Janny's mouse ears off and put them on the bedside table. Then I went out to the back porch. I flipped the lid on the piano and sat down to play. Therapy, for one. Usually, the music took hold of me, helped me work through or forget whatever was bothering me. Tonight, the blues just came out angry and all wrong. I switched to Brahms, something more soothing, but it didn't help in the least. My pianissimo sounded forte, and my arpeggios were like boots clomping up and down stairs. I finally stopped mid-phrase, hands over the keys. In the silence, I heard the sharp intake of my own breath, an involuntary gulp of air. What if I lose little Alex? Chapter 32. Nothing could be worse than this. Nothing I could imagine. A few days later, we all flew out to Seattle for Alex's custody hearing. The whole Cross family went west again. No vacation this time, though. Not even a short one. The morning after we arrived, Janny, Damon, and Nana sat quietly behind me on the courtroom benches as we waited for things to get started. Our conversation had dropped off to a tense silence, but having them there meant even more than I would have thought. I straightened the papers in front of me for about the 10th time. I'm sure I looked fine to everyone, but I was a wreck inside, all hollowed out. Ben Abazian and I were seated at the respondent's table on the left side of the room. It was a warmly appointed but impersonal space, with honey-colored wood veneer on the walls and standard-issue contemporary furniture. There were no windows. Not that it mattered. Seattle was showing off its dark, rainy side that morning. When Christine came in, she looked very fresh and put together. I'm not sure what I expected. Maybe some outward indication that this was as hard for her as it was for me. Her hair looked longer, pulled back in a French braid. Her navy suit and gray high-collared silk blouse were more conservative than I was used to with her, and more imposing. She looked as if she could be another lawyer in the room. It was perfect. Our eyes met briefly. She nodded my way without showing any emotion. For a second, I flashed onto a memory of her looking at me across the table at Kincaid's, our old favorite dinner spot in D.C. It was hard to believe these were the same eyes meeting mine in this courtroom, or that she was the same person. She said a brief hello to Janny, Damon, and Nana. The kids were reserved and polite, which I appreciated. Nana was the only one to be somewhat hostile. She stared at Christine all the way to the petitioner's table. "So disappointing," she muttered. "Oh, Christine, Christine, who are you? You know better than this. You know better than to cause harm to a child." Then Christine turned back and looked at Nana, and she seemed afraid. Something I'd never seen in her before. What was she afraid of? Chapter 33. Ms. Billingsley sat on Christine's left, and Ben was on my right, blocking our view of each other. That was probably a good thing. I didn't want to see her right now. I couldn't remember ever being so mad at anyone before, especially not someone I had cared for. "What are you doing, Christine? Who are you?" My mind whirred as the hearing began and Anne Billingsley went into her slickly rehearsed opening statement. It wasn't until I heard the phrase, "born in captivity," that my focus really snapped into place. She was talking about the circumstances of little Alex's birth, after Christine had been kidnapped while we were on vacation in Jamaica, the beginning of the end for us. I began to see that Billingsley was every bit the viper Ben had made her out to be. Her wrinkled face and cropped silver hair belied a certain lawyerly showmanship. She hit all her key words hard and with perfect enunciation. "Your Honor, we will discuss the many dangers encountered by Ms. Johnson's son, and also by Ms. Johnson herself, during a brief, tumultuous relationship with Mr. Cross, who has a long history of involvement with the most extreme homicide cases, and a long history of putting those around him in jeopardy." It went on and on from there, one loaded statement after another. I glanced briefly in Christine's direction, but she just stared straight ahead. Was this really what she wanted? How she wanted it to go? I couldn't interpret her flat expression, no matter how I tried. When Ms. Billingsley was through assassinating my character, she stopped her manic pacing and sat down. Ben stood up immediately, but he stayed right next to me throughout his opening speech. "Your Honor, I needn't take up a lot of the court's time at this point. You've seen the trial brief and you know the key factors in this case. You already know that the first seeds of this arbitration were planted on the day that Ms. Johnson abandoned her newborn son. You also know that Dr. Cross provided Alex Jr. with the kind of loving home any child would want during the first year and a half of his life. And you know that the longest bond, as they call it, the one we share with our siblings, exists for little Alex at home in Washington, D.C., with the only family he knew, up until last year. Finally, we all know that structure and opportunity for success are key issues in determining what is best for a child in the unfortunate circumstance of separated parents. I will say right now, and I believe you will agree, that a home with a father, great-grandmother, brother, sister, and numerous cousins and aunts nearby would provide a more thoroughly supportive experience for a child than to be raised by a mother who lives 3,000 miles from what little family she does have, and who thus far has changed her mind twice about her own commitment to the child in question. Having said that much, I'm not here to malign Ms. Johnson. She is, by all accounts, a perfectly decent parent when she chooses to be one. What I am here to do is illuminate the common-sense conclusion that my client's son, and any child, is better off with a parent whose commitment has never wavered and shows no sign of doing so in the future. In our pre-trial meetings, Ben and I had agreed to keep everything civil, if we could. I knew ahead of time what he was going to say, but here in the courtroom, and in front of Christine, it sounded different to my ears. It now seemed depressingly combative, not unlike what Anne Billingsley had just done to me in her opening. I felt a little guilty. No matter what kind of mud Christine's lawyer wanted to fling, at the end of the day I was still responsible for my own actions, and even my lawyer's. That was something Nana had hardwired into me a long time ago. One thing hadn't changed, though. My resolve was still strong. I was here to bring my youngest son back home to Washington. But listening to Ben Abasian's statement, I had the feeling that this case would have no winners. It was only a matter of who lost less. Hopefully, it wouldn't be little Alex who lost. Chapter 34. Ms. Johnson, can you please tell us in your own words why you are here today? I wondered if anyone else could see how nervous Christine was on the stand. She grasped the fingers of one hand with the other, stopping all but the tiniest bit of shaking. I couldn't help grimacing, and my stomach was tightening up. I hated to see her like this, even now, under the circumstances that she had created for herself. When Christine answered Anne Billingsley's questions, her voice was steady, though, and she seemed perfectly at ease. It's time for my son to have a permanent arrangement and stability in his home life. I want to ensure him the kind of consistency I know he should have. And most of all, I want him to be safe. Billingsley stayed in her chair, feigning, or maybe feeling, supreme confidence. Could you please tell us about the events leading up to your separation from Mr. Cross? Christine looked down and took a moment to gather herself. I couldn't imagine that she was acting right now. Her integrity had been one of the reasons I fell in love with her, in that previous lifetime of ours. Just after I became pregnant, I was kidnapped and held hostage for 10 months, she said, looking up again. The people who kidnapped me were out to hurt Alex. When that terrible time was all over, I found it impossible to return to a normal life with him. I wanted to, but I just couldn't. And just for the record, by Alex you mean Mr. Cross? Not Agent or Dr. Cross, but Mr. Cross. Any little dig the lawyer could get in. Even Christine winced. But then she said, "That's right." "Thank you, Christine. Now, I want to go back just a little bit. Your son was born in Jamaica while you were being held hostage. Is that correct?" "Yes." "Was he born in a hospital in Jamaica or under any medical supervision?" "No. It was in a small shack in the woods, the jungle. They brought a midwife of some kind, but she didn't speak English, at least not to me, and there was no prenatal care at all. I was extremely thankful that Alex Jr. was born healthy and stayed that way. Essentially, we lived in a prison cell for those months." Ms. Billingsley got up, crossed the room, and handed Christine a tissue. "Ms. Johnson, was this abduction the first time that your involvement with Mr. Cross brought violence into your life?" "Objection!" Ben was on his feet right away. "I'll rephrase, Your Honor." Billingsley turned her solicitous smile back to Christine. "Were there any other violent incidents prior to or after your son's birth related to Mr. Cross's line of work that directly affected you?" "There were several," Christine said without hesitation. "The first time was just after we met. My husband at the time was shot and killed by someone Alex was looking for in another terrible homicide case. And then later, after our son was born and when he was living in Washington with his father, I know that at least once Alex Jr. was taken out of the house in the middle of the night for safety's sake. Actually, all of the Cross children were taken out of the house. A serial killer was coming after Alex. Billingsley stood at the petitioner's table waiting. Finally, she pulled a stack of photographs from a manila folder. Your Honor, I would like to submit these as evidence. They clearly show Mr. Cross's home on the night of one such emergency evacuation. You will see my client's son here being carried out by a non-family member in the midst of the confusion that was apparently taking place. I wanted to yell out my own objection to this so-called evidence. I knew for a fact that it was John Sampson and not some nameless police officer who carried little Alex out that night, the night Christine had a photographer, a private investigator, outside my house. No one had been in danger because we had acted judiciously and quickly. But the photos were allowed to speak for themselves, at least for the time being. It got worse from there. Anne Billingsley walked Christine through a series of misleading events related to my job, virtually putting words in her mouth. The charade concluded with the trip to Disneyland, which the lawyer dressed up as some horrible minefield of dangers for little Alex, whom I abandoned to go searching through Southern California for a psychopath who could terrorize my family again. Chapter 35. Then it was my turn. The time Ben spent interviewing me on the witness stand was the hardest and trickiest ordeal I'd ever faced, with the most at stake. He had coached me not to address the judge directly, but it was hard not to. My little boy's future was in her hands, wasn't it? Judge June Mayfield. She looked to be about 60, with a stiff beauty shop kind of hairdo that was more middle America 1950s than New Millennium Seattle. Even her name sounded old-fashioned to me. As I sat in the witness chair, I wondered if Judge Mayfield had children. Was she divorced? Had she been through anything like this herself? I'm not here to say negative things about anyone, I said slowly. Ben had just asked me if I had any concerns about Christine as a parent. I just want to talk about what's best for Alex. Nothing else matters. His nod and the pursing of his lips told me that that was the right answer. Or was the look merely for the judge's benefit? Yes, absolutely, he said. So could you just please explain to the court how Alex Jr. came to live with you for the first year and a half of his life? Sitting there on the stand, I had a direct sight line with Christine. That was good, I thought. I didn't want to say anything here that I wasn't willing to say to her face. I explained as straightforwardly as I could that Christine hadn't felt prepared to be with me or raise a child after what had happened in Jamaica. I didn't need to dress it up. She had chosen not to stick around, period. She'd told me that she was unfit to bring up Alex. Christine had used that word, and I would never forget it. How could I? And how long would you say it was between Ms. Johnson's abandonment? Objection, Your Honor. He's putting words into his client's mouth. Overruled, said Judge Mayfield. I tried not to invest too much in her response, but it felt good to hear the overrule anyway. Ben went on with his question. How long would you say it was between that abandonment and the next time Ms. Johnson actually laid eyes on her son? I didn't have to think about it. 7 months, I said. It was 7 months. Yes, 7 months without seeing her son. How did you feel about that? I guess I was surprised to hear from Christine more than anything else. I had begun to think that she wasn't coming back. So had little Alex. That was the truth, but it was hard to say out loud in the courtroom. Our whole family was surprised by both her absence and then her sudden return. And when was the next time you heard from her? When she said she wanted little Alex to come live in Seattle. By that time, she had already hired a lawyer in D.C. How much time had passed this time? Ben asked. Another 6 months had gone by. That's it? She abandons her son, sees him 7 months later, goes away again, and comes back wanting to be a mother? Is that how it happened? I sighed. Something like that. Dr. Cross, can you tell us now, from the heart, why you are asking for custody of your son? The words just poured out. I love him tremendously. I adore little Alex. I want him to grow up with his brother and sister and his grandmother, who raised me from the time I was 10. I think Jenny and Damon are my track record. I've shown that whatever faults I have, I'm more than capable of raising happy, and if I may say so, pretty amazing kids. I looked over at Jenny, Damon, and Nana. They smiled my way, but then Jenny started to cry. I had to look back at Ben, or I thought I might lose it too. I noticed that even Judge Mayfield had looked over at the kids, and that she seemed concerned. I love my children more than anything in the world, I said. But our family isn't complete without little Alex, or Ali, as he likes to be called. He's part of us. We all love him dearly. We couldn't leave him for 6 months, or 6 minutes. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Nana nodding, and she looked infinitely wiser than Judge Mayfield in her high chair and black robes, especially when it came to raising kids. Please go on, Alex, Ben said quietly. You're doing very well. Go on. If I had my wish, Christine never would have left Washington. Ali deserves to have us both around, but if he can't have that, then he should be with as much of his family as possible. I don't think he's bad off here in Seattle, but this is supposed to be about what's best for him. And as I said, I don't know what this is worth, but I love him so much. He's my buddy. He has my heart. And then I did tear up, and definitely not for effect or the benefit of the judge. Testimony continued through the afternoon and for much of the next morning, and it was brutal at times. After closing arguments from the lawyers, we waited out in the courthouse hallway while Judge Mayfield considered her next move. You were great, Daddy. Jenny held my forearm and nuzzled my shoulder with her head. You are great. We're going to get Alex back. I can feel it. I put my free arm around her shoulder. I'm sorry for this, but I'm glad you guys are here. Just then, a court clerk came out to call us back inside. His blank face showed nothing, of course. Ben spoke quietly to me on the way in. This'll just be a formality. She's probably going to take it under consideration, and we'll hear back anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks. I'll motion for a revised temporary visitation agreement in the meantime. I'm sure that won't be a problem. You were great on the stand, Alex. No worries there. You can just relax for now. Chapter 36. As soon as we were gathered back in the courtroom, Judge Mayfield came in and sat at the bench. She fiddled with her skirt, and then didn't waste any time. I've considered all the testimony and the evidence put before me, and I've reached my decision. Based on everything I've heard, it all seems very clear. Ben looked reflexively at me, but I wasn't sure what the look meant. Ben? I whispered. Court rules for the petitioner. Residential parentage will remain with Ms. Johnson, upon whose counsel I will lay the burden of facilitating a mutually agreed-upon visitation schedule. The judge took off her glasses and rubbed her eyes, as if ruining a life was a tiresome part of her day. She then continued. Given the geographic disparity, I am, however, encouraging creative solutions, and I am ruling that Dr. Cross will be entitled to the equivalent of at least 45 days visitation per year. That's all. And just like that, she rose and left the room. Ben put a hand on my shoulder. Alex, I don't know what to say. I'm stunned. I haven't seen a ruling from the bench in 5 years. I'm so sorry. I barely heard him, and I was hardly conscious of my family swarming around me. I looked up to see Christine and Anne Billingsley squeezing past to leave. "What happened to you?" I asked, the words just coming. It was as if every muscle of control I had been exercising for the past couple of days gave out at once. "Is this what you wanted? To punish me? To punish my family? Why, Christine?" Then Nana Mama spoke. "You're cruel and you're selfish, Christine. I feel sorry for you." Christine turned from us and started to walk away very quickly, without saying a word. When she reached the courtroom doors, her shoulders hunched forward. Suddenly, she put a hand to her mouth. I couldn't tell for sure, but I thought that she began to sob. Ms. Billingsley took her by the arm and ushered her out into the hallway. I didn't understand. Christine had just won, but she was weeping as if she had lost. Had she? Was that it? What had just happened inside her head? A moment later, I entered the hallway in a daze. Nana was holding one of my hands, Janny the other. Christine was already gone, but someone else I didn't want to see was waiting there. James Truscott had somehow gotten inside the courthouse, and his photographer, too. What the hell was with him? Coming here, now. What kind of story was he writing? "Tough day in court, Dr. Cross," he called up the corridor. "Care to comment on the ruling?" I pushed past him with my family, but the photographer snapped off several invasive pictures, including single shots of Damon and Janny. "Don't print a single picture of my family." I turned to Truscott. "Or what?" he asked, standing defiantly with his hands on his hips. "Do not put my family's pictures in your magazine. Do not." Then I yanked away the photographer's camera and took it with me. Chapter 37.
Late that same day, the storyteller was driving north on the 405, the San Diego freeway, which was moving okay at about 40 or so, and he was working over his hate list in his mind. Who did he want to do next? Or if not next, before this thing wound down and he had to stop killing or be caught? Stop. Just as suddenly as it had begun. The end. Finished. Story over. He made a scribbly note in a small pad he always carried in the front door pocket. It was difficult to write as he drove, and his car edged a little out of its lane. Suddenly, some mook to the right sat on his horn and stayed on it for several seconds. He glanced over at a black Lexus convertible, and there was this total moron screaming at him, "Fuck you, asshole! Fuck you!" and giving him the finger. The storyteller couldn't help himself. He just laughed at the red-faced idiot in the other car. The jerk was so out of it. If he only knew who he was going postal at, this was hilarious. He even leaned over toward the window on the passenger side, and his laughter apparently made the nutcase even angrier. "You think it's funny, asshole? You think it's funny?" the guy screamed. So the storyteller just kept laughing, ignoring the irate bastard as if he didn't exist and wasn't worth coyote piss if he did. But this guy did exist, and actually, he'd gotten under the storyteller's skin, which really wasn't advisable, was it? Eventually, he drifted behind the Lexus, as if chastened and remorseful, and then he followed. The mook's black convertible got off two exits later. So did he. And this wasn't in the story. He was improvising now. He continued to trail the convertible's taillights up into the Hollywood Hills, onto a side road, and then up another steep hill. He wondered if the driver of the Lexus had spotted him by now. Just to be sure he did, he started honking and didn't stop for the next half mile or so. Figured the other guy might be getting a little spooked by now. He sure would if it were him, especially if he knew who he had hassled down on the freeway. Then he pulled out and started to pass the convertible. This was the coolest goddamn scene yet. He had all the windows open in his car, wind whipping through. The driver of the Lexus stared over at him, and he wasn't cursing or flipping him the bird anymore. Nahu was showing a little remorse. The storyteller's right hand came up, aimed, and he fired four times into the other driver's face. And then he watched the convertible veer into the rocky wall on the side of the road, carom off, swerve back onto the road, then hit the rocks again. Then nothing. The annoying bastard was dead, wasn't he? Deserved it too, the asshole. The shame of it, the pity, was that sooner or later this killing had to stop. At least that was the grand plan. That was the story.
Chapter 38. Detective Jean Galetta floored her 2-year-old Thunderbird. She had driven faster than this before, but never on L.A. city streets. The storefronts on Van Nuys blurred past her while her siren droned a steady rhythm overhead. Two black and whites were parked in front of the cafe when she got there. An unruly crowd had already begun to clot the sidewalk across the street. She was sure that TV cameras wouldn't be far behind, and news helicopters, too. "What's the situation?" she barked at the first officer she saw, who was half-heartedly doing crowd control. "All contained," he said. "We did a silent approach front and back. There's a few of our guys up on the roof, too. You've got about 2 dozen customers and staff inside. If she was still here when we pulled up, then she's still in there." That was a big if, but it was something to go on, Galetta thought to herself. Mary Smith might still be inside. This thing could end right here. Please, dear God. "All right, 2 more units inside as soon as you can get them here. 2 more on crowd control, and keep that guard front, back, and top." "Ma'am, this isn't my crew." "I don't care whose crew it is. Just get it done." She stopped and stared into the officer's eyes. "Am I clear? Do you follow?"
"Perfectly, ma'am."
Galetta headed inside. The cafe was one big rectangle with a coffee bar in front and rows of computer carrels in the back. Each electronic terminal was its own little booth with shoulder-high privacy walls. Everyone in the place had been corralled at the mismatched tables, chairs, and couches. Galetta quickly surveyed their faces. Students, yuppies, senior citizens, and a few Venice Beach hippie freak types. An officer reported to her that they had all been searched and no weapons were found. Not that it meant anything. For now, they were all suspects by default. The manager was a very nervous young guy in horn rims who didn't look old enough to drink and who had the worst case of acne Galetta had seen since her high school days in the valley. A mini CD-ROM pinned to his chest said, "Brett," in red magic marker. He showed Galetta to one of the computer carrels near the back.
"This is where we found it," he said.
"Is there an exit this way?" Galetta asked, pointing down a narrow hallway to her left. The manager nodded. "The police are already back there. They sealed it off. And do you keep some record of who uses the machines?" He pointed to a credit card swiping device. "They had to use that. I don't really know how to get the info out, but I can find out for you."
"We'll take care of it," Galetta told him. "Here's what I want you to do, though. Keep everyone in here as comfortable as you can. To be honest, it's going to be a while. And if anyone wants anything, make it a decaf."
She gave him a wink and a grin that she didn't feel, but it seemed to calm the poor guy down some. "And ask Officer Hatfield over there to come see me." She had met Officer Bobby Hatfield briefly once before, and she always remembered his name because it was the same as one of the Righteous Brothers. She sat at the computer and pulled on a pair of latex gloves. "What do you know so far?" she asked when Hatfield came over.
"Same kind of message written to the same guy at the Times, Arnold Greiner. It's possible someone got hold of those other emails, but this feels like her to me. You've heard of Carmen DiBruzzi, right?"
"The chef? Of course. She's got her own show. I watch it occasionally. I just don't cook."
Trattoria d'Abruzzi was a flavor-of-the-month restaurant in Hollywood, an A-list dinner and after-hours place. More important, Galetta knew, Carmen d'Abruzzi had a very popular syndicated show in which she cooked for her beautiful husband and her two perfect children. Everything was a little too perfect for Galetta's taste, but she did watch the show sometimes. Galetta shook her head. God damn it. D'Abruzzi's just this killer's type. Have you found her yet?
That's the kicker, Hatfield told her.
She's fine. No problem. A little freaked out, maybe, but okay. Same with her family. We've got a unit at her house already. Check it out. Whoever wrote that email never sent it or even finished it.
Jean Galetta's head bobbed again.
What the hell? She didn't send it?
Maybe she got spooked for whatever reason, wasn't thinking clearly, and just left. Maybe she didn't like the coffee here. I sure don't.
Galetta stood up and looked over the assembled customers and staff again. Or maybe she's still here.
You really think so?
Actually, no fucking way. She's not dumb. Still, I want to talk to every one of these dinks. This place is a closed box until further notice. Do some initial screening, but no one leaves without going through me personally. Understand? No one. Not for any reason. Not even if they have a note from their mom.
Yeah, okay, Hatfield answered. I got it.
As Hatfield walked away, Jean Galetta heard him mutter something like, calm down, under his breath. Typical. Male cops tended to respond one way to a man's orders and another to a woman's. She shrugged it off and turned her attention to the half-finished email on the screen.
Half-finished? What the hell was that all about?
Chapter 39
To A. Greiner at LATimes.com from Mary Smith to Carmen d'Abruzzi. You worked at your restaurant until 3 in the morning last night, didn't you? Busy, busy girl. Then you walked 2 long blocks by yourself to your car. That's what you thought, isn't it? That you were all alone? But you weren't, Carmen. I was right there on the sidewalk with you. I didn't even try to be careful. You made it easy for me. Not too bright. So into yourself. Me, 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 me. Maybe you don't watch the news. Or maybe you just ignore it. Maybe you don't care that someone is out there looking for people just like you. It was almost like you wanted me to kill you. Which is good, I guess. Because that's what I wanted, too. Watching you. Trying to be you. I had to wonder if you ever told your 2 darling children to look both ways when they crossed the street. You sure didn't set a good example for Anthony and Martina last night. You never looked around. Not once. Which is too bad for all of you. The whole damn pretty-as-a-picture family as seen on your cooking show. There's no telling when your children might end up alone on the curb without you, is there? Now they'll have to learn that important safety lesson from someone else. After you got...
Chapter 40 It ended just like that. In mid-sentence. Even if it hadn't, this was a whole new wrinkle in the case. Carmen d'Abruzzi wasn't dead, and they had the death threat note. That was something positive, right? Jean Galetta squeezed her eyes shut, trying to process the new information quickly and correctly. Maybe Mary Smith drafted her messages ahead of time and then finalized them post-homicide. But why leave this one here? Would she do it on purpose? Was this even her at all? Might not be. Jesus Christ, the questions never ended on this one. So where the hell were the answers? How about just one answer for starters? She thought about Alex Cross. Something he'd said in that book of his. Keep asking until you find the keystone,
the one question at the heart of it all. Then you can start working your way back out again. That's when you start finding answers. The one question. The keystone. What the hell was it? Well, 6 hours later, it was still a mystery for Galetta. Just after dark, she finally let the last of the morning's customers go home. 5 people had given 5 different eyewitness accounts about who was sitting at the computer in question. The rest of them had no clue. No one Detective Galetta spoke to struck her as remotely suspicious, but all 26 would require follow-up. The paperwork alone was more than she wanted to think about, now or ever. To no one's surprise, Mary Smith's credit card turned out to be hot. It belonged to an 80-year-old woman in Sherman Oaks who didn't even realize it was gone, a Mrs. Debbie Green. Nothing else had been charged on the card. There was no paper trail, no anything. She's careful and she's organized, for such an obvious nutcase. Galetta asked Brett, the manager, for a full-strength espresso. From here, it was back to the office, where she would sort through the day's events while they were fresh in her memory. Her neighbor said he'd let the dog out. The Chinese place along the way to her office said 20 minutes for pickup. Life was good, no? No. She wondered if she'd be home before midnight, and even then, if she'd be able to sleep. Probably not, on both counts. So what was the one question she needed to ask? Where was that keystone? Or was Alex Cross just full of shit? Chapter 41. She never knew what she wanted, sugar. Maybe she still doesn't. I like Christine, but she was never the same after what happened in Jamaica. She has to move on, and so do you. Samson and I will hold up at Zinni's, a favorite neighborhood dive. B.B. King's I Done Got Wise was wailing on the jukebox. Nothing but the blues would do tonight. Not for me, anyway. What the place lacked in cheeriness, it made up for in Raphael, a bartender who knew us by name and had a heavy pour. I contemplated the scotch in front of me. I was trying to recall if it was my 3rd or 4th. Man, I was feeling tired. I remembered a line from one of the Indiana Jones movies. It's not the years, honey. It's the mileage. Christine's not the point, though, is she, John? I looked sideways at Samson. The point is little Alex. Ali. That's how he calls himself. He's already his own person. He patted me on the top of my head. The point is right here on your skull, sugar. Now you listen to me. He waited until I sat up and gave him my full attention. Then his gaze slowly drifted up to the ceiling. He shut his eyes and grimaced. Shit. I forgot what I was gonna say. Too bad, too. I was gonna make you feel a whole lot better. I laughed in spite of myself. Samson always knew when to go light with me. It had been like that since we were 10 years old and growing up in D.C. together. Well, next best thing, then, he said. He motioned to Raphael for 2 more. You never know what's gonna happen, I said, partly to myself. When you're in love, there's no guarantee. Truth, Samson said. If you'd told me I'd have a kid, ever, I would have laughed. Now here I am with a 3-month-old. It's crazy. And at the same time, it could all change again. Just like that. He snapped his fingers hard, the sound popping in my ears. Samson has the biggest hands of anyone I know. I'm 6'3". Not exactly chiseled, but not too shabby, and he makes me look slight. Billy and I are good together, no question about it, he went on, rambling but making sense in his way. That doesn't mean it can't all go crazy someday. For all I know, 10 years from now she'll be throwing my clothes out on the lawn. You never know. Nah, my girl wouldn't do that to me. Not my Billy. Samson said, and we both laughed. We sat and drank in silence for a few minutes. Even without conversation, the mood darkened. "When are you going to see little Alex again?" he asked, his voice softer. "Ali. I like that. Next week, John. I'll be out in Seattle. We've got to finalize the visitation agreement." I hated that word. Visitation. That's what I had with my own son? Every time I talked about it out loud, I wanted to punch something. A lamp, a window, glass. "How the hell am I going to do this?" I asked Samson. "Seriously. How can I face Christine, face Alex, and act like everything's okay? Every time I see him now, my heart's going to be aching. Even if I can pull it off and seem okay, that's no way to be with your kids." "He's going to be fine," Samson said insistently. "Alex, no way you're going to raise messed up kids. Besides, look at us. You feel like you turned out okay? You feel like I turned out okay?" I smiled at him. "You got a better example to use?" Samson ignored the joke. "You and I didn't exactly have every advantage, and we're just fine. Last I checked, you don't shoot up, you don't disappear, and you don't lay a finger on your kids. I dealt with all that, and I ended up the second finest cop in the DC force." He stopped and smacked his head. "Oh, wait. You're a lame-ass federal desk humper now. I guess that makes me DC's finest." Suddenly, I felt overwhelmed by how much I missed little Alex, but also by John's friendship. "Thanks for being here," I said. He put an arm around my shoulders and jostled me hard. "Where else am I going to be?" Chapter 42. I woke up suddenly to a slightly bemused flight attendant staring down at me. I remembered that it was the next morning and I was on a United jet back to L.A. Her curious expression indicated she had just asked a question. "I'm sorry," I said. "Could you please put up your tray table? Put your seat forward. We'll be landing in Los Angeles in just a few minutes." Before I had drifted off, I'd been thinking about James Truscott and how he'd suddenly appeared in my life. Coincidence? I tended not to believe in it. So I'd called a researcher and friend at Quantico and asked her to get me some more information on Truscott. Monty Donnelly had promised that soon I'd know more about Truscott than even I wanted to know. I gathered up my papers. It wasn't a good idea to leave them out like that, and not like me. It was also unlike me to sleep on flights. Everything was a little upside down these days. Just a little, right? My Mary Smith file had grown considerably thicker in just a few days. The recent false alarm was a conundrum. I wasn't even sure that Mary Smith was behind that one. Looking at the murder reports, I had a picture of someone who was growing more confident in her work, and definitely more aggressive. She was moving in on her targets, literally. The first site, the Patricia Bennett murder, was a public space. The next time was outside of Antonia Schiffman's home. Now, all indications were that Mary Smith had spent part of the night inside Marty Lowenstein Bell's house before eventually killing her in the pool. Anyway, here I was back in L.A. again, getting off a plane, renting a car, even though I probably could have asked Agent Page to pick me up. Looks-wise, the L.A. Bureau field office put D.C. headquarters to shame. Instead of the claustrophobic maze I was used to back east, this was 9 stories of open floor plan, polished glass, and lots of natural light. From the cubicle they had assigned me on the 15th floor, I had a great view of the Getty Museum and beyond. At most field offices, I'd be lucky to get a chair and a desk. Agent Page started hovering about 10 minutes after I got there. I knew that Page was a sharp enough guy, very ambitious, and with some seasoning, he was going to make a good agent.
but I just didn't need somebody looking over my shoulder right now. It was bad enough to have Director Burns on me, not to mention the writer James Truscott. My Boswell, right? Or was he something else? Paige asked if there was anything at all that I needed. I held up my file. This thing is at least 24 hours cold. I want to know everything Detective Galetta has over at LAPD. I want to know more than Galetta has. Do you think you could... On it, he said, and was gone. It wasn't a bogus assignment I'd given him, though. I really did need to get current, and if that meant Paige would be out of my hair for a while, all the better. I pulled out a blank sheet of paper and scribbled a few questions I'd been pondering on the ride in from LAX. M. Lowenstein Bell. How did someone get inside the house? Does this killer have some kind of hit list? An established order? Are there other less obvious connections between the victims? Don't there have to be? The most common formula in my profession is this. How plus Y equals who? If I wanted to know Mary Smith, I had to consider the comparisons and differences, the combination of the two, from site to site on every one of the murders. That meant a stop at the Lowenstein Bell residence. I wrote, emailer / perp. I kept coming back to that point. How much intersection was there between the killer's personality and the persona in the emails? How honest, for lack of a better word, was Mary Smith's writing? And how much of it, if any, was misdirection? Until I could figure that out, it was like chasing two suspects. If I was lucky, my next appointment would shed some light on the emails. Tool sets? I wrote another note to myself. Most pattern killers had two sets of tools, as did Mary Smith. First were the tools of the actual murder. The gun was a sure thing here. We knew she used the same one each time. We weren't as sure about the knife. And a car had to be considered. Any other way of getting in and out seemed unfeasible. Then there were the tools that helped her satisfy her psycho-emotional needs. The children's stickers marked A or B, and the emails themselves. Usually these were more important to the killer than the actual weapons. They were her way of saying, I was here, or this is me. Or possibly, and this was the troubling part, this is who I want you to think I am. In any case, it was a kind of taunting, something that could be taken as, come and get me, if you can. I scribbled that last thought down, too. Come and get me, if you can. Then I wrote down something that kept sticking in my craw. Truscott. Appeared 6 weeks ago. Who is James Truscott? What is his deal? Suddenly I looked at my watch. It was time to leave the office if I didn't want to be late for my first appointment. Requisitioning a bureau vehicle would have meant one more person looking over my shoulder, and that's exactly why I'd rented a car at the airport. I left without telling anyone where I was headed. If I was going to be acting like a homicide detective again, I was going to do it right. Chapter 43. This was real police work, at least, and I threw myself into it with renewed energy and enthusiasm. Actually, I was pumped up. Professor Deborah Papadakis had my full attention as she beckoned me into her book-lined office, number 22, in the Rolfe Building at UCLA. She took a neatly piled stack of manuscripts from the only available chair and set them on the floor. I can see you're busy, Professor. God, are you ever busy. Thank you for agreeing to meet, I said. Happy to help if I can. She motioned for me to sit. I haven't seen Los Angeles so preoccupied since, I don't know, maybe since Rodney King. It's kind of sad. Then she raised a hand and quickly added, although that's not the same, is it? Anyway, this is a bit unusual for me. I'm more of a short story and personal essay kind of person. I don't read true crime, or even mysteries for that matter. Well, I do read Walter Mosley, but he's a closet sociologist.
Whatever you can do, I said, and handed her copies of Mary Smith's emails. At the risk of repeating myself, we would appreciate your complete confidence on this. That was for my own sake, as well as the investigation's. I hadn't gotten official permission to share the emails with her or anyone else. Professor Papadakis poured me a cup of coffee from an old percolator, and I waited while she read, then reread the emails. Her office seemed to be a bit of prime real estate at the university. It looked out to a courtyard and sculpture garden, where students rode and soaked up the perfect Southern California weather. Most offices in the building faced out to the street. Ms. Papadakis, with her antique pine desk and O. Henry Award on the wall, gave the impression of someone who had long since paid her dues. Except for the occasional, she was unresponsive while she read. Finally, she looked up and stared my way. A bit of the color was gone from her face.
Well, she said with a deep breath, first impressions are important, so I'll start there.
She picked up a red pencil, and I stood up and came around to look over her shoulder.
See here, and here. The openings are active. Things like, I am the one who killed you, and I watched you having dinner last night. They're attention-grabbing, or at least they're meant to be.
Do you draw any specific conclusion from that? I had some of my own, but I was here for her perspective.
She bobbed her head side to side. It's engaging, but also less spontaneous, more crafted. This person is choosing her words carefully. It's certainly not stream of consciousness.
May I ask what else you see in the writing? This is very helpful, Professor Papadakis.
Well, there's a sense of detachment, let's say, from the character's own violence.
She looked up at me, as if for approval. I couldn't imagine she was usually this tentative. Her air was otherwise so earthy and grounded.
Except maybe when she talks about the children.
Please go on, I said. I'm interested in the children.
What do you see, Professor? When she describes what she's done, it's very declarative. Lots of simple sentences, almost staccato sometimes. It could just be a style choice, but it might also be a kind of avoidance. I see it all the time when writers are afraid of their material. If this were a student, I would tell her to pull at those threads a bit more, let them unravel.